Welcome. My name is Divine. This is the 53rd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. Today I'm going to be continuing the Reno part of things. This will be the second part of the Reno review. It's going to be three parts. I already uploaded part one. This will be part two. And then there'll be a part three. And that'll be the final part. Okay. So first slide says the region of the kidney most susceptible to infarction in the setting of systemic hypotension. This would be the proximal tubule, right? Because the proximal tubule is the most metabolically active, right? Does a lot of stuff, right? So if there's not enough blood, not enough nutrients, it will die first, right? The person that consumes the most resources is more susceptible to ischemia, if you may. And then if you want to trace the pathway of urine to the outside world, right? So it's like you sort of start with the, glomerulus, right? You filter urine into like Bowman's space, and then it goes to the proximal tubule, goes through the thin descending limb of the loop of Henle, the thin ascending limb of the loop of Henle, and then the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. And then you form the distal convoluted tubule that contains the macula densa. Remember, the macula densa is actually simple columnar epithelium. And then you form the distal convoluted tubule, right? And then you form the principal cell. Basically, you form the collecting ducts that includes the principal cell, the alpha intercalated cell, and the beta intercalated cell. And then you form like the renal calyces, form the renal pelvis, form the ureters, and then you form the bladder, and then bladder to the urethra, and then the urethra to the outside world, okay? And the two types of nephrons, right? We have like the corticomedullary nephrons and the corticonephrons. And the shared anatomical characteristic between the kidneys, ureters, pancreas, and ascending descending colon. So go back to your first year of med school. Remember Satpucker. Those are retroperitoneal structures. And then next one is a 53-year-old male with stage 5 chronic kidney disease is being considered for renal transplantation. A HLA-matched donor has been found to ensure optimal transplant outcomes. What is the preferred donor kidney, right? So this is the left kidney, okay? The thing is, the left kidney just gives you more room to work with because it has a longer renal vein. So you have like more tubing, if you may. And then just one real quick thing I want to say is that I was talking about the pathway of urine, right? From the kidneys to the outside world, right? Between the renal pelvis and the ureter, that's a region known as the ureteropelvic junction of ureteropelvic junction. So it's the junction between the renal pelvis and the ureters. That is actually the most common location where there's like a failure to recanalize, which may actually cause like hydronephrosis in a fetus, right? So if you do a newborn ultrasound, you see like hydronephrosis, that can arise from a ureteropelvic junction obstruction. So next slide. So 58-year-old female presents with a 6-month history of urinary urgency and frequency. She cannot make it to the bathroom in time before she pees on herself. Urodynamic studies are notable for a post-void residual of 50 cc's or 50 mL. So what's your diagnosis, right? So this is obviously urge incontinence, right? And this really arises from the buzzword pathophysiology. I want to remember is like detrusor hypermotility, okay? Or like detrusor instability. Your detrusor muscles are just a little too touchy, right? So they contract like way too often, so that can cause urge incontinence. And classically, these patients have a low post-void residual, okay? Low post-void residual. So basically, because they are just peeing so much all the time, there's actually not much left in their bladder at any given point in time. So the thing is, if you know that your detrusor muscles are like a little too touchy, right? You may sort of want to quieten them down, right? But if you understand your autonomic nervous system, the pharmacology makes perfect sense. The thing is, your sympathetic nervous system, if you activate it, that shuts down your detrusor muscles. Your parasympathetic system, if you block it, that also shuts down your detrusor muscles, right? So you can give muscarinic antagonists, right? So like oxybutynin, tolterodine, darphenazine, solifenazine, and trospium, right? There's a mnemonic for that. It's on the darn toilet. So the on is for oxybutynin, the is the tolterodine, the darn is like darphenazine and solifenazine, and then the T is for trospium, right? So the T in toilet. Alternatively, you can also give a sympathetic agonist like a beta 3 receptor agonist like mirabegron. So if you watch TV at all, I know that's not a thing that's common amongst med students who are like actually like, you know, like enjoy your life and watch TV. But if you've heard of the drug mibritric is it's mirabegron. It's a beta 3 agonist that's used to treat urge incontinence. Okay, and the classic exam demographic for urge incontinence is a patient that has like multiple sclerosis. Okay, so just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Now, what would your diagnosis be in a patient with constant urinary dribbling and a post-void residual of 400 mL? Okay, if you ever see that, think about more an overflow incontinence. Overflow incontinence is the one that's associated with you're just dripping urine all the time, right? But the post-void residual is usually pretty high. And the Boswell pathophysiology is from like from detrusor muscle, like hypomotility. So basically, like, your bladder cannot sense when it's full. So usually this arises with, like, again, it can happen with MS, it can happen with diabetes. You can't sense when the bladder is full. So when the bladder is just overfull and you can't take it anymore, you begin to drip urine, okay? So that's why the post-void residual is a little higher than normal in these patients. And the classic demographic, again, patients with diabetes. And the way you treat this is, since the detrusor muscles are quiet in this disorder, you want to give a muscarinic agonist for this, right? So like bethanycol. Or you can give something that can raise your levels of acetylcholine to then encourage those detrusor muscles to contract. So you can give something like neostigmine, right? It's an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor that boosts your levels of acetylcholine, and that will promote drainage of promote contraction of the detrusor muscles. Alternatively, you can also tell the patients to like catheterize themselves on a fairly regular basis. Okay, and then the last one says a 60-year-old female that loses urine with coughing or sneezing, and it's like, what's the buzzword, what's the diagnosis, how do you screen for this, how do you treat this, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so let's talk about this, right? So the thing is, this is stress incontinence, right? So like you lose urine with anything that increases intra-abdominal pressure, like coughing or sneezing. That's stress incontinence. And really the buzzword is, pathophysiology is that basically the thing that happens is you have urethral, so not ureters, urethral hypermobility. And the thing that happens is for some reason, you essentially, because under normal circumstances, if you bear down and increase your intra-abdominal pressure, you transfer that, intra-abdominal pressure equally to the external urethral sphincter. So that sort of prevents you from like losing urine from the bladder when you increase intra-abdominal pressure. But if something bad happens and you're basically like your urinary tracts, like your urethra, sort of like falls out of sync with the abdominal cavity, when you increase the intra-abdominal pressure, that pressure is not transmitted equally to the urethra, okay? And then those people can pee when they increase the intra-abdominal pressures. And really the way you treat screen for this is you do something called a Q-tip test. You literally insert a Q-tip into the urethra and you'll see that it goes, I think, more than 30 degrees or something like that to show you that there's some kind of urethral hypermobility going on. Again, you screen with a Q-tip test, and the way you treat this is you do a Kegel exercise that sort of strengthens your levator ani muscles, right? So like it's like there's like iliococcygeus, there's pubococcygeus, there's puborectalis. Those are strengthened by Kegel exercises. If that doesn't work, then you can insert a pessary. That sort of like is like a plastic that holds everything in the right spot in the pelvis. Alternatively, you can also do something called a urethropexy. That's a surgical procedure. And the most common cause of stress incontinence in men will be like after like surgery for like prostate cancer or something like that. Okay. So, next question. 15-year-old male is brought to the ED with a chief complaint of severe headache. Vital signs are notable for a blood pressure of 180 over 110. Labs are notable for hypokalemia, basically, a hypernatremia, and an alkalosis. Okay. He recently consumed large amounts of a legume that was brought by a friend from India. Right. So what's your diagnosis? And I'll just tell you that this legume is licorice. Okay, so licorice, right? So how does licorice, consuming a ton of licorice, explain these findings, right? So the thing is, licorice contains an acid known as a glyceretic acid, okay? Glyceretic acid inhibits an enzyme known as 11-beta-HSD2. So 11-beta-HSD2. The full name is like 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2. The thing is, that enzyme converts cortisol to cortisone, right? So under normal circumstances, a lot of the cortisol in your body will make it into cortisone, not a huge deal. And the reason your body will want to do that is that cortisol has agonist activity at mineralocorticoid receptors. Cortisone does not. So, because I mean, we make a ton of cortisol on a fairly regular basis. I mean, think about if you're a med student, right? You're stressed all the time. You're making a crap ton of cortisol, right? So that cortisol can activate mineralocorticoid receptors. So the body sort of avoids that by converting it to cortisone with 11-beta-HSD2. So the thing is, if you consume the ton of licorice, you consume the ton of glyceric acid, that basically inhibits 11-beta-HSD2. So you don't convert cortisol to cortisone. So you have a lot of cortisol sort of persistent. And that cortisol can activate mineralocorticoid receptors, and you can basically get like a hyperaldosteronic effect, if you may, right? So like you'll have like hypokalemia because that potassium channel at the principal cell of the collecting duct is wasting a lot of potassium. You get a hypernatremia, right? Because you, again, you're basically acting like aldosterone. So that innate channel at the principal cell will work like too well, or the sodium chloride symporter at the distal convoluted tubule will work too well, and you reabsorb a ton of sodium that way, right? So you get a hypernatremia. And you also be hypertensive because you're expanding your blood volume. Okay, so basically this phenomenon I described is known as the syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess, right? So it's like an apparent excess because you're getting a, like a hyperaldosterone effect, but it's not because you have high levels of aldosterone. It's because you have high levels of cortisol, okay? So if you actually measured aldosterone in these people, because they are hypertensive, you dial down the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, so the renin will be low, angiotensin 1 and 2 and aldosterone, and ADH will all be low, okay? And really, the way you can make this diagnosis, you can just basically like take the person's urine, check how much cortisol there is, check how much cortisone there is. The ratio of cortisol to cortisone in the person's urine will be high in a SAME, okay, in a syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess. And then this could also be a genetic disorder. There's literally people that have genetic deficiencies of 11-beta-HSD2. And if you know that you're getting all these symptoms and signs, right, because you're having like too much activation of the mineralocorticoid receptors by cortisol, it makes perfect sense, right, that you should inhibit those mineralocorticoid receptors, right? So you can use an aldosterone receptor antagonist like spironolactone or eplerenone, although remember that spironolactone can cause like big boobies. Sorry, it can cause gynecomastia, right? So that's the more appropriate term. So it can cause gynecomastia, right? So because remember, spironolactone also has an androgen receptor blocking activity, right? So you can give spironolactone or eplerenone, but you give eplerenone if you want to avoid the gynecomastia that comes with a spironolactone. Okay, and then in Kahn syndrome, right? So Kahn syndrome, it's like an adrenal adenoma, right? It's in the zona glomerulosa, adrenal cortex, making a ton of aldosterone, right? So your levels of aldosterone will obviously be high, right? And again, you will have all these hyperaldosterone effects like hypokalemia, hypernatremia, metabolic alkalosis, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, your renin, right, because of your expanded blood volume and your hypertension, again, your renin will be low, your angiotensin 1 and 2 will be low as well, okay? So insane. You have low levels of renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, aldosterone, and EDH. But in Kahn syndrome, because you have like an actual tumor making a ton of aldosterone, your aldosterone will be high, but you're, because of the negative feedback, your renin, angiotensin 1, and angiotensin 2 will all be low. Okay, very high yield to know that. And then if you have Bader and Gitelman syndrome, right? So Bader is like taking a loop diuretic. Gitelman syndrome is like taking a thiazide diuretic. Basically, those things all make you volume down, right? So that will dial up your renin, angiotensin, aldosterone system, right? So your renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, and aldosterone will all be low, okay? In Kahn syndrome, right? In Kahn syndrome, I already talked about your findings there. If you have renal artery stenosis or like fibromuscular dysplasia, right? So that's like, I sort of think of fibromuscular dysplasia as like younger persons or renal artery stenosis. You'll basically hypoperfuse your afferent arterial, right? And if that happens, obviously, that will activate your GG cells. They will secrete a crap ton of renin. So your renin will be high. Your angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, and aldosterone will all be high as well. Okay? And if you had a renin-secreting tumor, it will be the same thing, right? If renin is high, everything downstream of renin in the renin, angiotensin, aldosterone system will be high as well. Okay? So next slide. So calcium balance in chronic kidney disease, right? So we talked about the mechanisms behind all of these already. You have hypocalcemia because you're not making calcitriol because there's no more 1-alpha hydroxylase, right? So you're not reabsorbing calcium and phosphate in the gut, right? So you'll be hypocalcemic. Your phosphate will actually be high, right? Because you may think about it, you're like, wait, divine. But in chronic kidney disease, I'm hypocalcemic, right? So if you're hypocalcemic, your PTH should be high, right? But the thing is, and PTH is appropriately known as the phosphate trashing hormone, right? So you think that your phosphate will be low. But actually, that's not the case in chronic kidney disease, right? Because your kidney is the primary excretory organ of phosphate. And if your kidneys are not functional, you have no ability to excrete phosphate. So you're actually hyperphosphatemic if you have chronic kidney disease. So chronic kidney disease will be an example of a cause of a secondary hyperparathyroidism. Okay. And again, I've talked about the pathophase. And really, the way you treat this is you give calcitriol, not calcidiol. You give 125 dihydroxyvitamin D, calcitriol. Because if you give calcidiol, it doesn't make any sense because there's no 1-alpha hydroxylase because you have no kidneys to activate that vitamin D. Okay? And in chronic kidney disease, the big thing you want to keep in mind is that your kidneys, again, they are the primary excretory organs of acid. Okay? So if you're not excreting acid appropriately, you will get a metabolic acidosis if you have CKD, and that can sort of leach away bone, okay? And then a hemoglobin of 8 in a patient with CKD, that's because you're not making EPO. I already talked about that before. Chest pain worsened with supination and relieved with sitting upright in a patient with CKD, right? So the thing is, if your kidneys are gone, right, you can deal with your urea problem, right? So your BUN will go up, so you get a uremia, okay? And the thing is, urea, or uremia, if you want to be more renal-like, I guess. Uremia, basically, urea makes it hard for things to degranulate, like your platelets, right? So you can have a coagulopathy with a CKD, right? So you can bleed because your platelets just don't work right. So, right, so your bleeding time, for example, will be elevated, although your PT-PTT will be just fine, okay, because it's a pure platelet problem. If your white cells cannot degranulate, right, you have like an increased risk of recurrent infections, right? So CKD is not good. In fact, infection is actually a fairly important cause of death in patients with a chronic kidney disease, right? Because again, their immune system cells cannot degranulate, so they cannot deal with infections appropriately. And then uremia can cause pericarditis. That's basically what this patient has, like chest pain, better when you sit up, worse when you lie back. That's supination. That happens in the setting of uremia. Uremia can cause something like a kind of a fibrinous pericarditis, if you may. And then the most common cause of kidney disease in the U.S., that's diabetes, okay? Second most common cause is hypertension. The easy way to remember that is that D comes before H in the alphabet, right? So diabetes is number one, hypertension is number two, okay? And again, if a patient has chronic kidney disease and you want to protect the kidneys, remember, I told you that diabetes, if you want to slow down like hyperfiltration injury with that whole intraglomerular hypertension business, you can take an ACE inhibitor, right? So that's the answer to this question, an ACE inhibitor and ARB. And then really for chronic kidney disease, there's a bunch of things you do, right? You try to sort of like restrict phosphate in the diet. You can give like a phosphate binder like sevelamer, right? You give like an ACE inhibitor, right? So that you can slow down kidney damage. You try to supplement vitamin D, right, so that they don't get like a secondary hyperparathyroidism, okay? And remember, again, the kidneys help you excrete potassium, right? So if you have, if you see a patient with CKD having like a wide QRS, big T waves, think about hyperkalemia, okay? And really, the way you manage severe uremia is you go ahead and just do dialysis. Remember, there's like an AEIOU mnemonic for the treatment for the for when a dialysis is indicated, right? So the E is like for severe acidosis, the E is for like a weird electrolyte imbalance, the I is for like ingestion, right? So let's say you take like ethylene glycol or something ridiculous, you can sort of dialyze that out. And then fluid overload is the O, and then the U is uremia, right? So if a person has severe uremia, go ahead and dialyze those patients. And then the next question, right? So peak T waves and rising creatinine in a patient receiving R-CHOP for some hematologic malignancy, right? So this is they have peak T waves, so they have hyperkalemia, right? And they have rising creatinine. So let's assume maybe they're beginning to get like some kind of uric nephropathy, right? So this is something that happens when you think about if you're receiving R-CHOP, right? You're killing like lymphocytes. And as you are lysing those lymphocytes, right, from a tumor like a lymphoma, right, remember that you make a lot of nucleotides, right, because lymphocytes divide a lot, right? So all those like purines, for example, can form uric acid under the activity of a xanthine oxidase, and that can basically cause like a urate nephropathy. Okay, so this is tumor lysis syndrome. And really, tumor lysis syndrome, again, arises because all the nucleic acids in your lymphocytes that are in the lymphocytes that are dying from like the killing of the lymphoma or leukemia, all those purines are made into uric acid, and then that clogs up your kidneys and you get into trouble. So how could you prevent this, right? One is you could hydrate the patient vigorously, right? Really, another thing you could actually do is to give allopurinol, right? That's a xanthine oxidase inhibitor. Xanthine oxidase helps you convert, basically make uric acid, right? So if you inhibited the enzyme that helps you make uric acid, like you, by giving allopurinol or febuxostat, then you can prevent the formation of uric acid, right? And then another thing you can do is if you sort of like think of birds, so birds they actually have pretty concentrated urine. And if you sort of think about it, with birds having pretty concentrated urine, they should be having like a crap ton of kidney stones. But that doesn't really happen in birds because they have this enzyme known as uricase, okay? Because birds like to conserve water, so they have concentrated urine, right? So they express uricase. Uricase actually helps them break down uric acid to something that's a lot more water soluble, known as allantoin, okay? So pharmaceutical companies have invented uricase analogs, if you may, right? So like rasboricase, pegloticase, those can basically turn uric acid to allantoin, okay? And that prevents you from having a urate nephropathy. And then the nephrotoxicity of cisplatin, this is just basically a hemon question. Cisplatin is nephrotoxic. You can prevent that by giving a drug known as amifostin. It sort of mops up the free radicals that may be observed with cisplatin use. Okay. And then the two high-yield antibiotic classes implicated in ATN, I already talked about these. Think about like your aminoglycosides like gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, streptomycin, and all that stuff. And then also your vancomycin, right, used to treat MRSA, covers gram positives only, right? That can also cause ETN. And then next one, this is just an association you need to know. A 26-year-old female who is 2 days postpartum is found to have large amounts of blood in her Foley catheter by the rotating med student. Her pregnancy was complicated by abruptio placentae. Okay, you'll learn about that in your third year in your repro blocks of med school. Abruptio placentae basically is like the placenta like falling off the uterus, literally. So she requires an emergency section, right? And she has a history of poor prenatal care and daily use of cocaine during pregnancy. Actually, using cocaine is a big risk factor for abruptio placentae. So this patient, this is just something you need to know. This is something known as diffuse cortical necrosis. It classically arises on exams in the setting of like an obstetric emergency where you lose a ton of blood, and then that causes necrosis of the renal cortex. Okay, so another reason I sort of bring this up is try to sort of differentiate between diffuse cortical necrosis and renal papillary necrosis. Renal papillary necrosis arises on exams in the setting of like chronic NSAID use or diabetes, which is actually the most common cause of renal papillary necrosis, or sickle cell disease. Okay, so it presents as like a painless hematuria, if you may. Okay. Contrast that with, again, diffuse cortical necrosis that, again, presents in the setting of like an obstetric emergency where you lose a crap ton of blood. Okay. And the potential pathophase phase, they believe that it involves like some DIC kind of thing going on. And your heme labs, right? If you have DIC, right, you have a lot of problems, right? Like your PTT. Basically, all your coagulation markers are all screwed up. Your PTT will be high, your PT will be high, your bleeding time will be high, right? Your INR will be high, like everything will all be screwed up with diffuse or cortical necrosis because it sort of involves a DIC like picture. And then the next question. So given the following clinical presentations, what is the most likely pathognomonic finding on your analysis, right? So first one says we have a 27-year-old male smoker, okay, presents with a 3-week history of hematuria and hemoptysis. And then a physical exam is... Yeah, physical exam is notable for extensive sinusitis. This is Wegener's, right? So you have like hemoptysis, hematuria, and upper respiratory symptoms. It can be sinusitis. It can actually be an ear problem. So don't be tossed by that on an exam. It can actually, because your ear sort of kind of constitutes your upper respiratory tract, right? So this is Wegener's. You can also see a saddle nose deformity as the upper respiratory tract thingy, okay? So that's Wegener's. Remember, it's C-ANCA positive, right? So because it's a kind of nephritic syndrome, you'll see red blood cell casts in the urine. And then the next one says 28-year-old male, recently started on empagliflozin for type 2 diabetes, presents with a 12-hour history of severe left-sided flank pain. A physical exam is notable for CVA tenderness, right? So this is pyelonephritis, right? So you see white blood cell casts. Now, 15-year-old female with no relevant past medical history was found 3 days after she got lost in a desert, right? So this is it's just a person that's volume down, right? So they will have concentrated urine. So you may find no casts at all, or like hyaline casts, okay, made of a TAM phosphorylated protein. And then 55-year-old female with rising creatinine after receiving a 30S inhibitor for the treatment of a life-threatening pseudomonal infection, right? So let's assume they got an aminoglycoside, right? So they probably have ETN, right? So you should see the muddy brown casts in the urine. Next one says a 45-year-old chronic alcoholic is found down on the street by police. His core temperature is 91, creatinine is 7, and potassium is 6. This is bad news, right? This is rhabdomyolysis, right? And again, I talked about this earlier. You find urine, dipstick, positive for blood, negative for red blood cells, right? So you see like 4 plus blood, but 0 to 2 red cells per high power field. If you do a urine microscopy, that's rhabdomyolysis. Next is 44-year-old HIV-positive male comes to his PCP with complaints of a 3-month history of swelling everywhere. Physical exam is notable for generalized anasarca. His serum albumin is 2. So this patient has FSGS, right? So this is a nephrotic syndrome. So you may find like fatty casts, like lipid casts in the urine with a Maltese cross pattern. Sort of as a micro tie-in here. Remember, Maltese cross pattern in your red cells, hopefully that gets you thinking of Babesia microti, okay? Babesia microti. And just real quick, sort of backtrack here, right? So a patient that has HIV has FSGS, right? What's the kind of FSGS they have? They have the collapsing FSGS. That's the one with the worst prognosis. It's actually pretty common in African Americans. And then I'll contrast that with the more benign one. I guess it's not benign, but it has a better prognosis, like the tip lesion. The tip lesion is a subclassification of FSGS. It has a more benign it gets a better prognosis, although FSGS in general is bad, but has a better prognosis, okay? And it's more common in Caucasians versus the collapsing FSGS that's found in African Americans, but it's primarily found in HIV positive patients. Now, next, last question says a 22-year-old female recently started on dicloxacillin for mastitis, right? So that's an anti-staphylococcal penicillin, presents with a 3-day history of a generalized upper body rash, right? So the temperature is 102.1, right? So this patient has a high fever, has a rash. I didn't give you the last part of the triad, right? The last part will be like eosinophils in the blood, elevated eosinophils in the blood and urine, right? So this is AIN, acute intestinal nephritis, right? So you'll find eosinophils, not eosinophilic casts. You'll find eosinophils in the urine. Eosinophilic casts, you find them in the urine in a chronic pyelonephritis. Okay, and then the last question in this series, second to the last, is what will be the classic USMLE hand X-ray finding in a patient on dialysis with stage 5 CKD? The big thing I'll just say is that let me talk about something before I answer that question, right? So in chronic kidney disease, again, you have no 1-alpha hydroxylase, right? So you're not making active vitamin D. So you do not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut, right? So you're hypocalcemic. If you're hypocalcemic, your PTH will rise, okay? Your PTH will rise. And if your PTH rises, it's the phosphate trashing hormone, right? So what should we throw of your phosphate? Should it be high or low? I know the answer you're itching to say is low, but it's not. It's high, okay? Because again, your kidneys are your primary phosphate excreting organs, right? So if you have no phosphate, if you have no kidneys, you have no phosphate excretion. So in CKD, secondary hyperparathyroidism, you usually have a hyperphosphatemia, okay? And because your PTH is always high, always leaching away at bone, right? You classically have like bone pain in CKD, right? And the buzzword you're looking for in exams is subperiosteal thinning of the bone. It's usually like the bones of the hand, okay? That's a like almost pathognomonic for hyperparathyroidism that may arise in the setting of a chronic kidney disease. So let's assume a patient has chronic kidney disease and they get a new kidney, okay? They get a new kidney, you basically fix their vitamin D problems, right? So the thing is, you may think that, oh, everything sort of returns to normal. That's not always the case, okay? Because the thing is, some patients with a history of chronic kidney disease, right, their parathyroid glands are just used to secreting a crap ton of parathyroid hormone all the time, okay? All the time. So those patients, they may get new kidneys, and the parathyroid gland may actually just still keep secreting a ton of parathyroid hormone. Okay, that's something known as tertiary hyperparathyroidism. It's like the parathyroid gland has just done the same thing for so long, it becomes unresponsive to normal signals. So in tertiary hyperparathyroidism, right, these patients have new kidneys, right? So their PTH is high because the parathyroid gland is, again, just autonomously secreting a ton of PTH. So their calcium will actually be high, okay, because now they have active vitamin D. Their phosphate will actually be low because it's now appropriately trashed by the new kidneys, okay, and you'll have like normal or high levels of active vitamin D. Okay, and really the way you treat hypercalcemia in patients that have CKD is you give them like calcitriol, like I mentioned earlier. If a patient has a primary tertiary hyperparathyroidism, you can give them, you can basically remove 3.5 of the 4 parathyroid glands. So you remove 3.5 of the 4 parathyroid glands to treat a tertiary hyperparathyroidism. Okay. Now, last question. Hemoptysis plus hematuria plus urinalysis revealing a red cell cast plus creatinine of 5 in a 25-year-old male smoker, right? So, I know you're itching to pick Wegners, but please don't, because this patient doesn't have upper respiratory symptoms. So, this is Wegner's granuloma. Good pasture syndrome, okay? Good pasture syndrome. Basically, you make autoantibodies against that pesky type 4 collagen that I mentioned in the first podcast, right? So, you make You make autoantibodies against the type 4 collagen, like the alpha 3 chain of type 4 collagen, right? And that's the pathophase behind the good pastures. And really, the way you make the diagnosis, you biopsy the kidneys, you do like light microscopy, you do immunofluorescence, you do electron microscopy. And really, the money shot here is immunofluorescence. You see a linear pattern along the glomerular basement membrane, okay? And really this, because you are making an antibody against like a fixed antigen, which is like your glomerular basement membrane, this is actually a kind of type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, just like an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, if you may. And really the way you treat this, basically use the Pathoma prescription, steroids and cyclophosphamide, okay? Although you can also try to get rid of those antibodies pretty quickly with plasmapheresis. That's the hematologic procedure that can help you get rid of the autoantibodies. And again, this is a kind of nephritic syndrome. If you want to be a little more specific, this is a kind of a type 1 RPGN. It's a type 1 rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. So you may actually find crescents on light microscopy of the kidneys. So I'm going to stop here, and then we'll have a third and final podcast that covers the rest of the renal material, and hopefully you should feel better with the renal material for step 1. Have a wonderful day and God bless. I'll see you next time. Thank you.